I'm Wendy Ring.
I'm Brian Curtis.
And this is Cool Solutions, stories of climate action from the bottom up, with the third and final episode in our mini-series about transforming U.S. agriculture. Part one was about ways farmers and ranchers can sequester carbon in their soil. Part two was about rebuilding local and regional markets. But here's the thing. Those changes rest upon one thing farmers must have first, access to land. Let's start here. Young farmers are the most likely to subscribe to good climate stewardship, but they are in short supply. Farmers over 75 outnumber farmers under 35 by 5 to 1. It's not that young folks don't want to farm.
Holly Rapon Butler from the National Young Farmers Coalition says that for aspiring new farmers, access to land is the biggest barrier.
Land access is the number one challenge that young farmers and ranchers are facing across the country. We know this from a survey that we did in 2017 of young farmers. And far and away, this was the number one challenge that current farmers are facing. It's the top reason that farmers were leaving agriculture, and also the number one reason that aspiring farmers weren't getting started. Lease opportunities can be a good way to get started, but that does not provide you with the security that you need to really build a farm business, build a market, and make the investments that you need to make. The reality is that as a young farmer, the property that you might need to purchase is going to be listed for a lot more money than you could get a bank to loan you based on your farming income. The private property system that we have and the way that land changes hands is not set up in any way to prioritize those who are feeding their communities. So for young farmers looking to access land, they're up against really monumental challenges.
A transition in land ownership is coming.
80% is owned by people over 55, and 40% is owned by people over 75. In the next 10 years, 400 million acres of farmland will change hands.
Unless we take action, much of that land will go to non-farmers, urban relatives and investors who already own 30% of U.S. farmland. These absentee landlords want a financial return now and are less ready to make long-term investments to move farming in a new direction. Add to that, we're losing farmland to development at a rate of 2,000 acres a day. So if the traditional real estate market won't deliver land to young farmers, what will? We found an answer. It started with a small nonprofit, got picked up by a state, and now there's a bill in Congress that could take it national.
Farmland in Iowa can run as much as 10,000 an acre, and that's without development pressure. That's just out in the middle of nowhere.
That's Susan Arum of the Sustainable Iowa Land Trust, otherwise known as SILT.
With places like Des Moines and Iowa City ranking high on lists of best places to live, development is consuming prime Iowa farmland.
The latest estimation from the American Farmland Trust is somewhere between 25 and 60 acres a day. And it's all around our major metro areas, but those, of course, are the primary food farming areas. If you want to be close to your market, you need to be close to a city.
As a rural Californian and an organic farmer myself, I was surprised to learn that nationally, that's where most food is grown. 90% of fruits, nuts, and berries, 81% of vegetables and melons, 66% of dairy, and 55% of eggs and poultry are produced on farmland close to metropolitan areas. So new farmers wanting to grow food instead of feed have to compete with developers.
You know, that makes it a pretty small space to operate, sandwiched between conventional commodity crops and development.
Here's the problem with the commodity crop side of the sandwich. 90% of corn and soy grown in the U.S. is genetically modified to be resistant to herbicides.
The farms here are so big now that they generally do aerial spraying. And of course, some of the latest chemicals have a very high volatility. They travel far. And so it's difficult to operate a farm near one of these places because one change in the wind can destroy your crop for the year. It can certainly destroy your organic certification.
Land trusts have historically been used to preserve wild places, but SILT has a different mission.
SILT came about by a number of people who had fought the good fight during the farm crisis of the 80s and wanted that to stop. We're in the middle of another farm crisis, whether it makes the news or not, we are in it. This time, the farm crisis is because land prices in Iowa have quintupled in the last 25 years. So anybody trying to buy land now, it's not your grandfather's farm we're talking about here. Farmers who are inheriting their farms, they have to buy their inheritance these days from their siblings who've moved out of state and expect a cash payout when the parents die. So even they aren't in a great place, quite honestly. SILT was created to allow the next generation of farmers to get off this treadmill of land speculation, narrowing one's choices through massive debt and through fewer and fewer buyers of your product. We take the land off the market for this one public good. A young farmer or an under-resourced farmer will be able to access that land, provide food for their community, and treat that land with the respect it deserves.
If that brings about visions of Soviet-style collective farms, rest easy. Land ownership, even under capitalism, is not all or nothing.
Land in America comes with a bundle of rights. They often talk about it as a bundle of sticks. When somebody gives us a piece of land, sometimes they just give us the deed, the right to sell the land. So they can't sell the land anymore because they gave us the deed. But they keep all the other rights. They have the right to live there. They have the right to farm it or lease it out and gain the income from that lease. And we have a number of landowners that do that. That's just in a land donation situation. In a conservation easement donation, they're not giving us the land. They're just giving away the right to develop it. So they're giving us a different stick that says, as a landowner, I no longer have the right to develop this into a parking lot or, you know, condos. And I've also given up the right to farm it in a way that reduces the soil quality because I've agreed to grow table food and do it in a sustainable way into the future.
So SILT can either hold the land and the easement in trust and provide a farmer with a long-term lease, or it can just hold the easement in trust and help a retiring farmer sell their land to another farmer who will honor it. Farmers who put their land in a conservation easement get substantial federal tax benefits.
Farmers get 100% deduction of their adjusted gross income up to 16 years. Now, that's not paying them dollar for dollar, but it's a pretty sweet deduction. And farmers know how to speak in terms of deductions. And there are 28 states, including Iowa, that provide some kind of public support or public funding for purchasing easements. We've also learned that farmers who get paid for easements almost always reinvest in their own farm. They take that money and they build new barns and they do all kinds of soil conservation. You know, they don't move to Bermuda with that money. And so it's often proven to be public funds well spent.
How different is an easement from just zoning land agricultural?
Zoning can change. Easements trump zoning. If there's zoning that changes and you have easement on a farm, the easement stands. There's only one chance to make it forever, and that's with a land trust.
Agricultural easements dramatically lower the cost to lease or purchase land in Iowa by around 40%.
So how does a would-be farmer get access to this cheap land?
If SILT owns the property.
Our farmer committee, which is all volunteers and largely farmers, created the application process. People have to have a business plan with 3-year cash flow projections. They have to answer some essay questions about how this farm fits into their life and their future. And they have to have some references. And then the farmer committee vets the applications and interviews the applicants. And there's all kinds of ranking criteria that skew towards farmers in need. We offer them a 3-year discounted lease. And then after the third year, if they've proven themselves to be good farmers and good neighbors, which is a pretty loosey-goosey estimate, but it's one of those things, you know it when you see it, we offer them a 20-year lease, which is the longest you can offer in Iowa. The farmer never owns the land, so they never have land debt. They get to rent it at a big discount, but they get to own the house and the farm buildings. After the third year, they get to pay into an equity fund, no interest, no down payment for 30 years to buy a house and farm buildings.
If SILT just owns an easement and not the property, they make sure potential buyers understand those restrictions.
We meet with the prospective buyer before the closing and say, hey, welcome to the neighborhood. Wanted you to know what you're signing up for here. The reason the land costs less is because you are expected to be a sustainable food farmer or keep the land in that kind of production. So what's your interest in farming? And this is their chance to get out of Dodge if they didn't understand that. Or it's their chance to get to know us if they did understand that. And then we go out once a year and we check on the property. We make sure that there's no condos going up on the back 40 and check in with the farmer, make sure everything's copacetic. And every once in a while, the land changes hands to someone who doesn't even care about the easement. And that's the time when we have to enforce it. We have to take them to court. And we have to set aside a fair amount of money to be able to do that. And we also pay into a national insurance program to help us pay our legal fees in case that comes up.
We may have some aspiring farmers listening. What if they're not in Iowa?
We're inviting people from California, Colorado, New York State, all those other high-priced places. And we currently have farms available. We have a 53-acre farm right now, beautiful, right outside of Omaha, so a major metro area, $225,000. If any of your listeners are interested, it's on our website. It's for sale. You just have to be a food farmer.
Jordan Klassen is a young farmer who recently bought a farm with a silt easement. He talked to me from his greenhouse until his phone overheated.
Been in a polar vortex for like the last 2 weeks, but I'm in the greenhouse now seeding down onions and early lettuces and bok choys and kales and chards.
Jordan's story is typical of the economic realities for young farmers. He was lucky to start with access to a few acres near Des Moines, owned by a family friend. The first 2 years, he had a full-time outside job, even after giving that up to farm full-time.
My first few years, I was washing dishes at my friend's restaurant in the wintertime just to make ends meet.
He and his wife, Whitney, used Kickstarter to raise $32,000 for a new chicken house and heated greenhouse. Now they work full-time on the farm, growing 60 varieties of fruits and vegetables.
We're not getting rich, but we've got a baby on the way and a one-year-old now. I mean, we're definitely able to make a living.
But after 10 years of farming, they were still on rented land.
I always knew that this was not going to be a permanent spot for us. I mean, they've had developers offer them like $3 million for the 10 acres here just because it's such a landlocked city and kind of a sweet spot. So I always knew that I needed to be looking for land if I wanted to farm the rest of our lives.
With increasingly erratic weather, Jordan wants to move more of his crops into high tunnels and greenhouses.
We had the derecho last year, which just ruined the whole Midwest. These weather patterns are getting crazier and crazier.
For those of you not from the Midwest, a derecho is like a tornado, except the wind blows straight instead of swirling. Last year's derecho had wind speeds up to 120 miles an hour. Now, Jordan can't build a bomb shelter for his plants, but he wants greenhouses to control the temperature and protect them from heavy rain. Multiple greenhouses are a major investment, and Jordan and Whitney want to put them on land they own. When they saw the farm Silt had on offer, it was love at first sight.
It just felt right. It was just like, this is it.
Without the agricultural easement, the 25-acre farm would have been too much.
It really dropped it down to make it affordable. No developer is going to want to buy property that's going to have to remain a vegetable farm. For us, we're A-okay with that because that's our long-term vision. Even if our kids don't want to pass it on, we hope it stays a food farm.
Right now, Jordan's got a foot in each farm, with vegetables on the old and garlic in the new. They've got a Kickstarter campaign going to build a barn on the new property.
We're calling it a modern-day barn raising. We're going to build a home this year and hopefully the barn and try to move in about this time next year.
Piece of cake, right?
Amen. Add another baby into the mix. Yeah, it'll be a fun year.
You can check out their virtual barn raising at gradeagardens.com. Jordan's not the only one counting on community to do what the real estate market won't.
Silt relies completely on donations of land and easements.
The whole notion of land speculation is baked into being an American. You buy land because it's a good investment, and you hang on to it for as long as you can, and then you sell it, and it's your retirement fund. So what if we had to find people who didn't believe that? That's a needle in a haystack, and yet we're finding them.
In its first 6 years of existence, Silt has 1,100 acres in sustainable food production, providing land access for 30 farmers.
Just to give it some perspective, according to Iowa State, which is not the bastion of local food production by any means, we can feed 200 people per acre per year, all the fruits and vegetables they need. So on just 10,000 acres or so, we could feed every man, woman, and child in Iowa all the fruits and vegetables they need. We just need to find the political will to spend more money on this kind of farm preservation.
Farmers' land is their livelihood, it's their equity, it's such a tremendous asset, but they put their blood, sweat, and tears into this piece of land. It's very emotional, and to see it turn into a housing development is something that a lot of farmers are looking to prevent.
That's Michelle Sheehan, director of Rhode Island's new Farmland Access Program. Rhode Island voters passed a green economy bond, which is funding a silt-like program to buy land from retiring farmers.
We think that it's a pretty competitive way for farmers to preserve the state's agricultural land while still getting a good value for their land.
Rhode Island has lost more than 80% of its farmland and launched their program to try to save what remains.
They have the most expensive farmland in the U.S., averaging $16,000 an acre.
Land prices are so high because we're such a dense state, sort of wedged between Boston and New York City. Farmland in Rhode Island that is being sold is extremely scarce. Prime farmland on the ocean can be $125,000 an acre. In our northwest corner, you can have parcels that are more like $5,000 an acre. We run the gamut. I just saw a farm. The total price for about 44 acres is over $1 million. So that's what farmers are up against when they're looking for land.
Removing the development rights before reselling to young farmers drops the cost 60 to 80%. Then the state protects that affordability with a buyback clause.
We have found that over time, the value of that restricted land tends to rebound. Those farms have the threat of being sold to someone who just wants a fancy house with a lot of land to look at. One way that we're addressing that is to build in option to purchase at agricultural value if we deem that sale to not be too a bona fide farmer or if it's being sold for an exorbitant amount of money.
Michelle says the program has to prove itself.
It was, I think, hard to swallow for a lot of people, the idea of the government purchasing farmland outright. So it hasn't been our goal to buy up every single piece of farmland as soon as it comes on the market and go, go, go. It's been really to build it slow and steady to be able to make the case to the public and then to appeal to them to fund it again.
Buying farmland on a large scale requires federal investment. There's a bill right now in the U.S. House and Senate that would do just that.
And right a historic wrong.
And promote climate stewardship for all farmers.
And get them out from under the heel of the meatpacking monopolies.
That's a lot. Let's break it down.
The Justice for Black Farmers Act would provide land grants for new black farmers as reparations for the many millions of acres of farmland lost as a result of racism over the last century.
Black farmers are relatively rare today, but back in 1910, one of every seven U.S. farmers was black, and together they owned 16 million acres of farmland. After a century of violent intimidation and systematic discrimination, more than 90% of that land is now owned by whites. Lynching and intimidation pushed some black farmers off their land in the early years, but most of the acreage was taken by quasi-legal means, exploiting something known as heirs property.
Savvy Horn is the executive director of the Land Loss Prevention Project, an organization founded by the North Carolina Association of Black Lawyers to stem the epidemic of black farmland loss in North Carolina.
Heirs property is when you have numerous people owning the same land.
Historic barriers to legal services meant that about 3/4 of early black farmers died without wills. Savvy gave us this example.
Great-grandfather had 4 children. He owned 100 acres. He died without a will back in 1910, the height of black land ownership. These children would each have 25% of interest in the land. If each child had 4 children through the approximate 6 generations to 2020, there would be something like 4,000 people owning that 100 acres. And oftentimes they have been scattered because of the great migration, South Carolina to Washington, D.C. to New York City, Alabama to Detroit, and Texas to L.A. And the land ownership is left behind to depossess members of the family and their ownership. Usually it's some outside influence.
Like a white farmer or developer with their eye on the land, or a foreclosure preordained by inflated property tax assessment, a form of systemic racism found throughout the U.S. All it takes is one heir who needs money.
Because it's tenancy in common, you would go to court to get your 1/4,000 percentage of that land.
and the court can auction off the whole property at below market value and divide the proceeds between the heirs without even notifying the other family members.
There are some places in which the land loss has been staggering. 14 million acres of heirs' property from the lowlands of South Carolina and Georgia have been lost since the Civil War using state law.
And it's still going on today.
One-third of Black-owned land in the South is still heirs' property. In many states, that means farmers can't get farm loans, receive disaster relief, or participate in federal farm programs. And that's not the only barrier Black farmers face in accessing federal benefits.
Ironically, the USDA is itself responsible for Black farmers losing millions of acres of land. The USDA put control over loans in the hands of white-dominated local committees who systematically discriminated against Black farmers, earning the agency the nickname The Last Plantation. In 1999, a group of African-American farmers took the USDA to court in a class action suit.
Black farmers complained that when they sought loans, those loans were denied. Farmers were told, come back next year. By the time you get to next year, it's the same old story. When the farmers did get the money, the loans were approved too late in the planting season. And then there was the issue of having supervised bank accounts. They would have to get the approval down at their local offices in their counties for the use of the money. What was established in the lawsuit that the U.S. Department of Agriculture had engaged its agents and some of its state office in systematic stripping down of African-American farmland ownership and the loss of Black farm population.
The settlement paid 13,000 Black farmers over $2 billion, the largest civil rights settlement in the United States.
But the lawsuit covered just 15 years out of a long history of discrimination.
The money was not enough to repair much. Farmers did get some debt relief, but at the end of the day, they didn't get back their land, and the next generation within the families never could re-enter agriculture because they had no base, they had no land.
One economic analysis pegged the intergenerational wealth lost because of USDA discrimination against Black farmers at $120 billion. The Justice for Black Farmers Act, introduced by Senator Cory Booker, would make reparations by providing land grants of up to 160 acres to 200,000 Black people who wish to farm over the next 10 years. The grants include an agricultural easement like silts, a buyback provision like Rhode Island's, and a requirement to farm in ways that sequester carbon.
The Booker bill has been a long time coming. It's a step forward for new African-American agrarianists grounded in regenerative agriculture and steeped in the African-American agrarian tradition, which is regenerative. May not have used the word, but the practices were.
George Washington Carver, the first director of the Department of Agriculture at Tuskegee University, and Booker T. Watley, who followed Dr. Carver on the faculty there, are both widely recognized, along with indigenous farmers, as the earliest practitioners and proponents of sustainable agriculture in North America.
Carver taught Black farmers to restore the fertility of soil depleted by cotton by rotating in nitrogen-fixing crops and adding back organic material.
During the 1960s and 70s, when the USDA was telling farmers to get big or get out, Watley promoted small farms with diverse year-round crops and is credited with inventing the concept of community-supported agriculture.
The bill provides funding for all farmers to adopt practices which sequester carbon by adding them to the list of conservation measures funded by the USDA.
It also brings independent oversight of civil rights at that agency, provides aid to farmers to resolve heirs' property issues, and supports agricultural education by establishing a farm conservation corps and funding agricultural programs at historically Black colleges and universities. And, this is big, it breaks up the power of the meat and poultry packing monopoly by prohibiting packers from owning animals and preventing exploitative contracts.
The need for antitrust action is something we've heard over and over as we've talked to farmers around the country.
Austin Frerich, deputy director of Yale's Thurman Arnold Project, agrees.
There's no more concentrated space in the American economy than in the agriculture markets.
In the supermarket, that's hard for us to see.
Back in the olden days, Standard Oil was one brand that had that big monopoly, whereas nowadays companies have an illusion of choice where they buy a bunch of brands because that Whole Foods shopper doesn't want to buy the same peanut butter as the Aldi shopper, but it's really the same peanut butter.
So take Tyson. I looked this up. Jimmy Dean, Hillshire Farm, Ballpark, Idell's, that's all Tyson, and there's more. And then Armour, Nathan's, Farmer John, and nine others, that's all Smithfield. These companies dominate their industries, which gives them great political power.
Smithfield not only is the largest slaughter of hogs in America, it's also the largest owner of hogs. It owns 1 in 5 hogs. By the way, Smithfield is now a state-backed Chinese company. They are now the largest payer into the pork producers. So now the voice of pig farmers does things in the interest of the company. You saw in 2010, President Barack Obama did hearings with USDA and DOJ across rural America. And you saw example after example, farmer after farmer, get up to the microphone. And these people risked their livelihoods and then nothing happened. The political courage to withstand industry pressure wasn't there.
Vertical integration in agriculture also gives companies too much power over farmers.
Tyson is fully vertically integrated. Tyson even owns the bird that its farmers raise. A Tyson's chicken farmer doesn't even own the animal. They just babysit it and then give it back to Tyson.
The limits imposed on meat packers in the Justice for Black Farmers Act decrease the industry's power to resist regulation and loosen the hold it has on farmers.
I would actually compare it to alcohol markets.
Austin says that in pre-prohibition times, beer was actually a loss leader for the vice industry.
Beer companies sold beer at a loss to get consumers drunk, so they wasted their money on gambling prostitution. That's how beer companies made their money. So then when we legalized alcohol, what we did is we diffused power. If you make beer, you distribute beer, and you sell beer, those are three different things. So you have Budweiser, the local distributor, and then you have wherever you buy your beer at the local store. So the whole point here is this is a poison. How do we diffuse the power, not let one entity get that powerful?
So justice for Black farmers, 200,000 new young farmers owning land, federal support for carbon farming, and chopping up the big meat monopolies.
It's about building a regenerative, racially equitable food system. By so doing, we will also have climate justice. We have to start now. We don't have any more time. And the Black Farmer Justice Act gives us what we need to make that come to fruition.
Go to cool-solutions.org to see what you can do.
I'm Brian Curtis.
I'm Wendy Ring, and you've been listening to Cool Solutions, Climate Action from the Bottom Up.
Thanks to our guests Holly Rippon Butler, Susan Arum, Jordan Klassen, Michelle Sheehan, and Savvy Horn.
And thanks to Scott Holmes, Michael Chapman, Kevin McLeod, Chris Haugen, and Dr. Turtle for our music.